Welcome to the Cutter's Notch podcast, named after the fictional small town found in several of author Michael DeCamp's books. This podcast explores anything related to creativity. You'll hear interviews with creative people, such as authors, artists, performers, and entrepreneurs, sprinkled with friendly banter about any number of topics, all of which attempt to view the world through the lens of creativity. Turn up the volume and enjoy the latest conversations in Cutter's Notch.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Cutter's Notch podcast. I'm your host, Mike DeCamp, and I'm running solo again today. My co-host is still out of town on business, and I'm missing her, but I'm not alone in the room. I'm here with my guest for this episode, Press Maxson. Hello, Press.
Hi, thanks for having me, Mike.
Press is an author, a creative director, a musician, a TED talker, and all sorts of things. So we're just going to kind of talk about some of his creative activities, how he got into them, how he runs with them, what he's got coming up, some of his books, things like that. So we're going to have a little fun with him today. But before we jump into that, I have to give you my creative indulgence.
Let's hear it.
So the last time it was about Stephen King's Never Flinch book. This time it's about a Netflix series, but it's based on Michael Connelly series of books, The Lincoln Lawyer. So Netflix has a series out called Lincoln Lawyer. Now, a few years ago, I watched a Matthew McConaughey movie, same name.
Right.
I think it's about the same character.
Okay.
But this is actually a mini series. It's got three seasons already. I'm almost done with season one already. I just started listening to or watching it a couple of days ago. So I've been binging it since I'm on my own without my wife around to keep me in control. But I like this series probably better than I like the Matthew McConaughey movie. Mm. Have you read any of the Michael Connelly books? I have not read the Lincoln Lawyer books at all.
Yeah.
I haven't read any of his Bosch books. Bosch was another series that he has. I watched a bunch of those. They've got, I think on Prime Video, there's a bunch of Bosch.
Yeah.
Several seasons of Bosch.
I've heard of it. I've never watched it.
The Lincoln Lawyer is pretty fun. It's a mystery, an extended mystery, but it's a legal base, kind of like a John Grisham kind of thing. Only maybe a little more. I don't know. Michael Connelly's got a different style than John Grisham, obviously.
Yeah.
So, but I'm really enjoying it. I'm enjoying it enough to binge on it.
Yeah.
I've had a little struggle lately finding a new series that I want to watch. So I'm glad that I tried it. So it's turned out pretty good. What about you? Do you have any creative indulgences, Press?
Yeah, definitely. I just got back from vacation, so I read a book on the beach. It's been a long time since I've binged a book. Just fully did it in two or three days kind of thing. It was a nonfiction book called The Wager, and it's by David Gran. It's super interesting because I'll just give you the back cover summary, is that a British naval warship in like mid 1700s disappears during a violent winter storm. And everybody presumed dead, obviously 400 sailors on board. And about 2 years later, 28 of them show up in a boat.
How many years later?
Two.
2 years.
2 years later in a tiny makeshift little boat. And they show up with beards down to their belly buttons and super emaciated. And they're the survivors from the shipwreck. And so they are heralded in England and among the King's Navy as heroes, you know. 6 months after that, three more guys show up from the same wreck. And they're even more emaciated.
Oh,
and
man.
They're sick. And they show up basically on a floating raft they made out of barrels. And they say, wait. Those previous 28 guys, they're not the heroes. They are the mutineers. And we're the good guys. They killed people. They stole from other sailors. They ate a guy. Yeah, they say, you know, those guys basically left the rest of us to die. they're not heroes. We're the heroes. And so it's just an interesting story of not just the ship and the voyage itself and the shipwreck and what they had to do to survive. But then it's just a game of he said when they came back and sort of like, well, who was in the right in really extraneous circumstances? I loved that book. So I got to recommend it, The Wager. I've read some other things. You talk about a mystery. I just finished The Silent Patient, a mystery. Never saw the ending coming. Loved it. That's by Alex Michael Medes. I wish I got time to watch a lot of TV, but I just did rewatch over the past 2 weeks Tim Burton's Batman movies from the 80s and 90s.
Oh, yeah.
I loved them. Hadn't seen them probably since I was 10, and loved those. And then, so that those are my creative indulgences.
Well, you know, the last episode I had a guy on, and we got to talking about different movies and things. And one of the movies he recommended was Sinners, with Michael B. Jordan.
Yes.
I think I said his name right.
Michael B. Jordan. Fairly recent movie,
yeah,
correct?
It's brand new. Just last few months. It's a vampire flick.
Mm-hmm.
And well, we ended up watching it. So after the episode, we recorded the episode, we went out and grabbed a bite to eat. And then we came back and we watched that movie.
Cool.
And I got to tell you, I didn't use it as my creative indulgence, but it was a heck of a movie.
Yeah.
I really liked it.
Interesting.
So it's probably my new favorite vampire flick.
Wow. So, cool.
So I would recommend Sinners. That's pretty good. Now, the book that you read, you say it was a true story?
Yeah, it was wild. It was one of those I closed the book and I couldn't believe I'd never heard of the story before.
I'm amazed at stories of sailors who get shipwrecked somewhere and they survive. They somehow survive for months and months and months. Yeah. What was the story of the guys who went to South America, Antarctica? Not South America. They went to Antarctica and South America, and they got shipwrecked. I can't think of the name of the but basically they were stranded on an island, and they ate seals and they ate fish and they somehow survived really cold temperatures and somehow made it. It was a crazy story. I wish I could remember the name of that book.
Yeah.
That was a true story as well.
And this, the one that I just read, The Wager, is similar area. They shipwrecked going down around the Horn of South America. Mm. And they made it through there. They lost the fleet through there. But they made it a little bit up the coast, a couple hundred miles up the coast, not very far. Got shipwrecked on an island there, but it was in the middle of our summer months, which meant it's in the dead of winter.
It's in the winter for them. Yeah.
And what blew my mind, to your point, these guys survived, went through unthinkable conditions with barely any workable clothing. Half of them didn't have shoes. People are losing toes left and right, you know. And they all get back to England, and they all just re-enlist. And they're all like, well, when do we go? When's the next one? These were career sailors who just, and granted, it sounds like in the Royal Navy, they were, you know, basically made legends because they'd survived this thing.
I think if I got back, I'd be like, oh, where's the nearest farm I can work
100%. I would not get back on the boat. I'd be like, I think I'm good.
Carriage driver. Right. Or something. I'll turn the lanterns on at night. I'm just not going out on a ship again.
I'd enjoy my fame and work the land.
Yeah. What was the name of the author?
David Gran with two N's, like G-R-A-N-N.
Okay.
David Gran.
David Gran, and it's the Wager.
The Wager. That's the name of the boat.
All right.
Kind of a cool allusion to what, you know, some things they had to go through.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So folks out there, you know, Press and I've known about each other for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. We were talking before the podcast recording started about how we got connected, and it was through a local author network in Indianapolis, because we're both authors. And I think we were scratching our head. It's like, when exactly was it? But one of the things I remember, Press, is probably 4 years ago or so, you did a Zoom call or something like that. And you, did
that
you have some, play some music?
I mean, I play music on most Zoom calls I'm on. Well, I guess it depends what you're asking about. I think I did a few kind of virtual meetups during the pandemic. Now that you mention it, did some virtual meetups with local authors from our group. Right. Actually, I think we were on that together.
Yeah.
I might have played music on that. I don't remember.
I remember one with you and me and Victor.
Yes.
Victor Prince, yep. Another author. Seems like you had something where you were putting it out and you were going to be, it was a play the ukulele or something. Do you play ukulele?
I play ukulele and it's a pretty easy one to play on Zoom, actually, because you can see the whole instrument and it's like nicely contained in your frame. You don't have to scoot your chair back from the desk to make room for a guitar or have other things around. You can still just be kind of right up
on
your camera and on your mic. That's the other important thing if you're playing an instrument. I don't remember why I would have played it, but it's on brand for me if I did.
Well, so. Yeah, I just remember maybe it was something on Facebook, but it's gone back a ways and cool. I've passed the 60-year mark. So who knows what I'm remembering anymore?
Well, I've done it often enough that you really could be referencing any number of times.
So how did you get into music? So tell me about your musical interests and the things you're doing there, because I saw when I did a little bit of research on you, I saw that you were also had done like the intro music for a podcast and you've done some other things. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. In a nutshell. So I was one of those kids who took piano lessons and just never quit, you know, and I was surrounded by music. My parents were in a church singing group and I mean, that predates me. So as long as I can remember, we were going to church and I was in the front pew while they were singing. And so because of that group, really, I was taking piano lessons. And then one of the people in that group had a electric guitar that they got at a garage sale and they gifted it to me. That would have been like third or fourth grade, somewhere in there. And it was right around there when I discovered the music of the Beatles. And all of a sudden this light bulb went on where I'd been taking piano for 2 or 3 years. But all of a sudden I thought, wait, I'm good enough to play a Beatles song that I love, you know? And so I loved the Beatles and all of a sudden I wasn't practicing music anymore. I was, you know, sitting there as a fifth grader with my guitar or at the piano, legitimately playing Beatles, like pretending I was in the Beatles. And I think that was the catalyst for when I sort of really realized music was going to be a fun road for me when I looked back at those years and I said, wow, I practiced a lot, but I wasn't practicing in my mind. I was just having fun.
You were just playing.
I was just playing.
Yeah.
And so if you know how to play guitar and piano, and then I played trumpet and trombone in the school band. If you know how to play those, you know, those kind of gateway instruments, all of a sudden, if you know how to play piano, that opens you to a whole different world of similar keyboarded instruments, whether that's, you know, relatives to the piano, like a harpsichord or a synthesizer or a keyboard or something like an accordion, which takes a different mechanism, muscular mechanism, but still has the keyboard and you already have that leg up. Or if you play guitar, there's a lot of, you already have the muscular mechanism to play bass or banjo or ukulele or mandolin or something because they're stringed instruments. Your left hand already knows how to clearly produce a note. Your right hand differs across those instruments, but for the most part, the mechanics of plucking a string, you understand. So yeah, you kind of accumulate all of those. And then the second kind of part of your question is I've found in my career, music is a really helpful additive. You know, when people find out you can do that, they ask you to do things for them, even if it has nothing to do with your day job. I've worked places in the past where they've said, hey, we need happy hour entertainment. I know this really isn't your job, but could you bring a guitar and you know, do something? And so I have this kind of nice little side fun thing where I still do a pretty good amount of music. I make music for the Brandon Peters Show podcast. I make music for the Earful Tower, which is a fairly popular podcast about Paris tourism. And that one keeps me pretty busy. There are, of course, on seasons and off seasons, but I have some wonderful creative collaborators in Oliver G and his team. He's the host, and I love making music for them. And so, and then I every now and then I'll just get the whim to play around town, go back to playing in bars like I used to, or playing in a band. I have a band of other friends of mine and we have a really good time. So it's nice to have that kind of world still available.
So you are in a band currently?
I mean, yeah, I am. Yeah. We're called the Walk-Ons. We play mostly 90s and 2000s era hits. We kind of joke, we're only an outdoor band. So we only play outside at block parties, or we played Victory Field this summer for an Eli Lilly event. We do corporate events, but we don't play more than a handful of times. We all have other things we want to do. We all have families and we definitely enjoy it. But I also sort of enjoy that it's not a full-time job. You know?
It's an occasional drop in, and you get a little extra cash out of it probably.
Exactly. And if any of the folks that are in the band with me are listening, I love you all. And when I say it's not a full-time thing, and I'm glad it's not a full-time thing, it's not a reflection of how I feel about you. I love you all.
What if somebody came along and said, "Press, we heard you play at Victory Field and you guys were incredible. How about signing this contract? And would you do it?"
I mean,
what would the rest of the guys be like?
That's a great question. I'm sure some folks would be more enthusiastic than others. I mean, I think all of us have that number in our heads, you know. You don't say no if it's really good, but the terms would have to be, and I feel the same way actually about publishing, if I were to sign a contract with a major publisher, it would have to be something very specific, because I'm kind of comfortable with what life looks like right now and with where my audience is and with how I, you know, market myself as a musician or as an author. It would really have to be a perfect deal. And I have a feeling if you'd asked me that same question when I was 24, I would have been like, "Where do I sign?" You know?
Yeah.
But
life changes things.
Life changes things, and I'm smarter. I'm smarter than I was when I was 24.
Well, I was thinking about it. I can't think of their name. You'll probably get it immediately. And you know, this is a very conversational podcast, so a lot of times things come to my mind. I don't really have the details behind it.
Sure.
But I was thinking about that group from that. They all went to IU.
You're thinking of Straight No Chaser.
Straight No Chaser. Yeah. And it's like they all went to IU. They did this thing while they were in school, and then sometime later, they all got back together and formed this group.
Yeah.
It's like a whole slew of them.
Yeah.
And they end up signing a recording deal, and they're touring and they're doing all this.
Yeah.
It's like, you imagine, you know, they probably had families, they had things going on, and the fact that they all kind of jumped back into it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is amazing. Pretty amazing. Their story is unbelievable.
Yeah. Now, I am not musically inclined. I love to listen to music. I like to tell the story that my elementary school music teacher left me completely out when she handed out recorders and she handed out other music things. It's like, I wasn't included in that.
Oh, no.
So could I have learned some stuff? Maybe.
Hit the womp womp button.
Womp womp. Yeah. So unfortunately, I had a guitar when I was a kid. Never learned to play it.
Oh, man.
I got a drum set. My dad got me a drum set, and I banged around, made a heck of a lot of noise, but never really learned to play it.
You know, it's never too late, Mike.
Well, that's what my wife says. See, now my wife, on the other hand, she took piano lessons, and her mom says that her mom used to say that they could tell what kind of day she had at school by how she practiced.
That's funny.
How hard she hit, or maybe it was her piano teacher. I can't remember, but she played piano, she played bassoon, she played, she was a drum major, so she was in the band, and she's got a guitar now, she's got a ukulele.
Cool.
So she's very much into music, and she has some skills. I don't share those. So I enjoy them from afar, but I do envy those of you who are talented musically.
Well, it's Nancy, right?
Yes.
I wish she was here, because I was the drum major too.
Yeah, so she would have enjoyed that conversation.
I would have loved to talk to her about that.
She'd been all over that. Well, tell me about your books. So that's how we got connected, because we're both authors. You got a new one out, relatively new, Chinatown Troubadour. We'll talk about that one in more detail in a minute, because I think it's got a fun story.
Yeah.
But I noticed some of your fiction. they seem to be located in France.
Right.
So what made you set your stories in France? How did that come about? Did you spend time over there or what's the story there?
Yep. So my aunt and uncle lived over there and my wife and I went to visit. And that was in 2011. I mean, I'd been over there several times before then, but that was my wife's first trip. And I was kind of on a real literary kick then anyway, as a reader. And I hadn't really written anything seriously since college at that point. But I was inspired by it and inspired by being there. And at the time, kind of inspired by the lost generation of writers, you know, your Hemingways and F. Scott Fitzgeralds and James Joyce's. And I thought, oh, I should try and write a book. And it's worth mentioning that this is right as we're having our first baby. And all of a sudden, the creative outlet in the house, I couldn't just make noise in the house, you know, whenever I wanted anymore.
You had to be a little more quiet.
Had to be far more quiet. So I thought, okay, what's my creative outlet that keeps me more quiet? And so I thought, okay, I'm going to dive into writing a book instead of writing music. And it was around this time I was getting really tired of playing in bars, and I'd been playing Doolin pianos for a long time. And I was just ready to kind of like keep those nights out in the past, you know? So I started writing, and because I was just in the Paris headspace, I did that one. And when I was writing the first one, I mean, I was very proud of it, but the entire time I'm going, I had an idea for the second one. And
which one was the first one?
Yep. The first one was called Bender at the Bon Parisian.
Okay.
And the idea there was, it was, you know, a couple spending an all-nighter in their hotel bar in Paris. And it was based on, it was absolute fiction, but it was based on an idea that had happened in reality at the hotel bar in Paris. So I wrote it about that, and I was kind of charmed by the idea of writing about the city. Like so many other fiction authors, I'm not new in that way. You know, that's not novel. And, but I had an idea I was really passionate about while I was writing the first one. I had an idea for the second one. They're not a sequel. They're totally unrelated stories, but my second book had a version of Paris in it that was less, I was trying to less make it less real than the original one. This was much more imagery and circumstances that were my own creative projection onto the city.
Is that Pigeon?
That's Pigeon.
Yeah.
And by almost every measure, it was better. I thought I'd executed on the story better. I thought I'd written better characters. And I was more proud of that. And then while I was writing Pigeon, I had the idea for the third book, which really, I mean, yeah, there's a part that's in Paris, but it's all over. I mean, the setting isn't just, you know, about Paris.
What's the third one then?
Okay. So the third one's called Bastards of the Revolution.
Okay. And yeah, I saw that one. I thought that was based in the US. So is it mostly in the US? And then
it's sort of all over. Paris? Yeah. It's sort of all over. And, really there was one in between Pigeon and Bastards that's out of print now. It was called Kevin on Earth, and it was much shorter. It was like 25,000-ish words.
That one still shows up on Amazon, by the way.
I don't think you can buy it though.
No, it says out of print.
Yeah, exactly.
So limited, it says out of print, limited availability.
Love
so
it.
I think, you know, I don't know if people like put it back on the market, you know, after they're done with it or what, I don't know, but, I was like, whoa, that's an interesting, cause it's like,
yeah,
it's about someone who is assigned to Earth for a study abroad program.
Yeah. It's an alien who's assigned to Earth. Yeah. And just his luck, he shows up in 2020, which was at the time the wonkiest year on record. Yeah. We've also had some doozies since.
But we're living in a doozy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, maybe we shouldn't go there.
Well, but, that one is much more of the moment. And I don't really reread any of these, but I opened up Kevin on Earth recently and I thought, you know, maybe this would be more fun as a time capsule and I could re-release it later on the 10th anniversary or 20th anniversary of the pandemic or something. But for now, I don't.
It might be fun
out there. Yeah.
You never know.
Yeah.
Well, that's a range because you've got this, the latest one, which is Chinatown Troubadour, which is a true story, mm-hmm. which we'll jump into that next, but your three books, basically two of them heavily in Paris, one of them partially in Paris.
Yeah.
Kind of historical fiction.
The last one, Bastards of the Revolution, is 100% historical fiction. So the idea there is, it's a modern day historian finds the diary of a colonial era woman who claims she was intimate with every single founding father. And
where did that idea come from?
I don't remember. Actually, wait. I think I do remember. It was, what was I? I remember. I haven't given an interview about this book in a long time, so I have to retrace my steps on interview prep for it. But basically, I went through a huge founding of America reading kick probably almost 20 years ago now. I mean, I think I read, what's his name? Joseph McCullough? No, David McCullough.
Yeah.
David McCullough's 1776. I think I read in about 06 or 07, and I loved it. So after that, I thought, I should read I should read a biography about Franklin. I should read a biography about Jefferson, about Washington. Oh, here's this different authors written about Jefferson. I'll read that one too, you know? So I read a ton for maybe 5 years, and all the while thinking, someday it'd be really cool to put my own stamp on this. But I thought, I'm not a historian, you know? So I can't. And that was wrong, but it was definitely right that I wasn't setting out to write someone's biography. What occurred to me, and I don't even remember which book now, but one of them was describing the scene when all these guys show up for the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787. At the time, there was no, obviously, television or radio media. The stars of the day were war heroes and political heroes. So when Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, George Washington, all these guys show up in one town, I guess Jefferson wasn't there. He was in Paris at this point. But when all these people show up in a town to do the Constitutional Convention, the historic fact is that crowds showed up on the streets to watch them come in. It was like an unofficial parade, watching them arrive. Mm-hmm. The same way a bunch of people show up to watch people walk into the Oscars, you know? So At some point I had this thought that, you know, women must have been, you know, women around who liked these guys the same way that celebrities attract people. These guys are celebrities, and that part probably isn't different. And what is different is the way the media reports on public figures. And what's different is the way things get historically recorded than they did back then. So I thought, it's no surprise that we've never heard of the founding groupies, but can we guarantee they were there? No. Can we almost assuredly guarantee that people were attracted to them? Probably, you know? And so I just imagined, I thought, okay, what's the imagined world that there was one woman who selected this group of people as a set of conquests?
Wow.
So I went for that.
Now, I think you just gave us the title of a sequel to that book, the Founding Groupies.
The Founding Groupies, right. Well, we could do it. That's for sure. So that's where that idea came from.
Well, tell me about, let's jump into Chinatown Troubadour. That's your latest one, right?
Yeah, I'm really excited about it.
So you're excited about it. It's new. And tell us about it.
Yeah, I tried to write nonfiction right out of college, and I just didn't find my voice. I didn't have sort of a POV for the writing itself. Not to mention, what I wanted to write about probably wasn't as compelling as I thought it might be. But ever since then, I just kind of assumed, after that failed project, I assumed I'm a fiction writer, and I really found happiness doing that. And I loved reading both nonfiction and fiction, but in particular, I liked the idea of building worlds and building characters. And then you can still say something. You can still make a statement about something you believe, or you can make a statement about the world in general, even if the story is fabricated. You can still make something that resonates with people as if it was happening to them. But there came a point when I kind of thought, you know, it's immature of me to believe I can't write something nonfiction. And that's really when I started thinking. I started a Substack account and I wrote only nonfiction, but really worked to make it not just a personal journal. I'm not a journalist, but I thought, what is happening out in the world? Where's a story I can find that I can filter through my own perspective and give my own voice to? And so after I kind of found my voice writing my Substack newsletter, I thought, all right, well, what's a story big enough to make it not a Substack story, but to make it a book? And that's where I thought of Lucky Chain, the lead character in this book, who's a real human being. And I thought, if I could find him again.
That's his real name, Lucky Chain?
No, that's not his real name.
Oh, so you fictionalize his name, but it's a true story.
No, he fictionalized his name. Oh, this is what he goes by.
He fictionalized his own name.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the story in a nutshell. I've spent the last 2+ years now looking for somebody I met in the mid-90s. He was a street singer who went by the name Lucky Chain in Europe. I met him for 10 minutes, maybe, cumulatively over that summer. And my friends and I, my sister and I, my cousin, my uncle, every few years, someone would say, hey, you remember that guy? What was his name? You know, and I'd say Lucky Chain. I have his cassette tape somewhere in a box at my parents' house. And they'd say, like, right, wasn't he goofy? Or like, boy, that guy, where is he now? You know? And so really when I sat down, I didn't sit down to write this book. It just started with me saying, oh, I wonder if I could find Lucky. I'm making music for the Earful Tower and I'm writing this nonfiction email newsletter. At some point I was going to ask myself, I wonder if I could find and talk to Lucky. And I started writing the book while I was searching, but not really on any timetable because I didn't know if I was ever going to find him. I didn't know what I didn't know what his real name was. Didn't know where he lived. Didn't know if he was still alive. The only leads I had were I knew what he looked like and I had his cassette tape from the 90s. And I found
him. And you had the name that he went by.
I had the name that he went by, but that showed up zero on an internet search.
Oh, really?
I mean, if you search Lucky Chain, just put in the words Lucky Chain on Google, it's nothing but, you know, cheap discount jewelry, charms and stuff.
Right.
It just wasn't specific enough. And so... yeah, it took 2 years, but I found him, and I don't know what I was hoping for or what I was expecting, but what I found was 1,000% better than anything I could have hoped for.
Really?
Or was expecting. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. So were you writing this all along as you were doing the search?
I was keeping notes.
You kept notes and compiled it after the search was over.
And the idea was, even if I didn't find him, I'd probably write a blog post about it or something, you know? So I was keeping track of everything that was happening, but I wasn't committed to writing a book. I remember I told, even when I found him, he didn't answer me right away. And when I reached out to him, I mean, he's elderly now. And... yeah.
Is he in the U.S. or is he overseas?
Not. He's overseas.
Overseas.
And there's a delay in our communications. And I was going to the Indianapolis Indians game the day I found him. And I'm in the car with one of my buddies. And I picked my buddy up at his house. And he said, how you doing? And I told him, I said, oh, you're not going to believe it. I found this guy. I've been looking for 2 years or whatever. And my buddy goes, you know, if he doesn't answer you back, you don't have a story. You still don't have the story. And I was like, ah, you're right. You know, and I kind of started feeling that way. Like I can't write the book or I don't have the story until first it was like until he emails me back. Then it was like, even after I heard from him and we started developing a rapport, it's like, I still don't have a story till I'm sitting in front of this guy and we're drinking coffee or I'm still not, you know, do I have a story until we play music together? You know, I didn't go that far, but that kept being the voice in my
right,
head.
Right. So did you actually get to sit down in front of him and have coffee?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. It's wild.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I have a copy of the book right here in front of me, folks, and I'm going to, press has told me he's going to let me have it. So
you can have it.
I'm going to have to read this. This will be next on my reading list.
For everyone listening, there's more going on with this book than just the story in the sense that it feels like a new beginning for me because it's my first shot at nonfiction. And sort of on a marketing side, I'm trying, or not marketing, but maybe product design side, every book I've written until now has gotten a little longer, you know? And I thought, okay, if I'm starting over with nonfiction, time to reset, time to pull back a little bit. Let me just deliver the story. There's not a lot of, I don't want to call it fluff, but it's a hyper-focused story, you know? And I thought, there's a lot of people that I know who don't consider themselves readers, but they still read, you know, they don't just go book to book to book to book. They read when they're on the vacation, or they maybe read a few pages before they go to bed at night. I thought, okay, I'm going to pare this back. I'm going to write something really digestible so that if someone binges it, they could be done in a day. Or if they just are reading, you know, 5 to 10 pages a night before they go to bed, they could get through this in like a week and a half,
something
much more digestible. So I hope that anyone who's inspired to read it after this finds it a quick and digestible read and refreshing in that manner.
And hopefully they'll enjoy it as much as you did in writing it.
That's always the goal, right?
And then tell a bunch of people about it.
Exactly. And then they'll read it.
Yeah.
And
then it just keeps going and it balloons. And then, and while they're at it, they're buying my latest book at the same time.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then we both get really wealthy and we move to Paris.
That's it. You know what's funny? The whole writing music for the Eiffel Tower, going to Paris fairly regularly in these last few years, but with relative regularity for over my entire life, but more frequently recently, writing about Paris, not just in a fictional sense, but in this book in a very real way. The side note is Chinatown Troubadour is not about your traditional Paris neighborhoods. I think many people who have been there on 1, 2, or 3 visits still probably never find their way to Chinatown. Mm-hmm. And I love it. It is 1,000% different than what you imagine in your head as Paris with your cobblestone streets and your charming little cafes and stuff, but it's a different deal. But my point is, I don't know, after all this, after being back and forth, I do love Paris. It is my favorite place to visit. I don't know that I have to live there though. Yeah. I don't know that I'd ever need to.
I wouldn't really want to.
No. I mean, it's beautiful. It is beautiful. And I love visiting.
I have yet to visit Europe.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Next year, it looks like we may be going to Iceland.
Cool.
At some point, which will be really, really cool.
Yes.
Literally and figuratively.
Oh, it's beautiful in Iceland.
I've heard that it's, I've seen pictures. It just looks incredible. I'm going to avoid the shark. Was it? Fermented shark. I'm not going to eat fermented shark.
I think you should.
I don't think so.
You get
have you had
culture.
Fermented shark?
No, I've had shark jerky. I don't know. Whenever I travel somewhere, I do try and like.
Apparently, you have to drink a shot of some sort of whiskey or something with it. So you eat the fermented shark and then you take a shot. And so
I would do that.
So maybe it's worth a shot.
I don't even really drink anymore, but I would do that. I would do that.
So I've never been to Paris. I've never been, but Nancy has. Nancy's
cool.
Been there. If she were here, she'd be all over that.
Oh, I'd love
about
to
it.
Hear. Yeah.
So how did you get, okay. In looking at your Amazon stuff. All right. So you can find Press on Amazon. Just put in his name, Press Max, and it's unique enough. Press and then Maxson. You put it in and it just pops his stuff up. It doesn't get mixed in with a bunch of other things. So you can see his books on there. You can see his book that is out of print. I think we mentioned that earlier. Mm-hmm. And he's also got a play.
Yeah.
It's
called Tavern on the Water.
Tavern on the Water, a play in one act.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
About 20 years ago when I've been in Indiana now 17 years. So it was right about the time I moved here. The rock band I was playing in Los Angeles, I don't know if this still exists, but back then there were all these tiny small theaters. I'm sure they still exist. Tiny theaters, a lot of aspiring actors and actresses would be in these really small productions. And a lot of the theaters, to make money, they'd put up the play, they'd have a bar kind of in the lobby. And then after the play, they'd reopen the bar and they'd have a band play on the stage, and they'd kind of have a happy hour post play kind of thing where actors and actresses could get drinks with the audience and stuff. So our band played those fairly regularly. And there was one night where I was like, this is such a small time operation, you know, that I said to one of my bandmates, I was like, I bet if we wrote a play, we could find a theater to put it up, you know? Well, wouldn't that be fun? You know, my bandmate was kind of like, whatever. He was like, I guess. And he said, knock yourself out. He said, I'm sure you could do it. So I tried. I've always had it in the back of my head to write a play. I tried back then, but I just didn't have a good idea. The pandemic came around and I had a lot of extra time to think about things I hadn't thought about in a long time. And I thought, you know, maybe it's time to try a play. And I still didn't have a good idea, but I had time to brainstorm it. So the idea for this play was pretty basic, and I had fun writing it and I had fun rehearsing it. But basically, it's for two actors, a guy and a girl, but each guy and a girl play three or four different roles, and they do very little to change their appearance in their, like, for the roles. Like, maybe they'll put on a pair of glasses when they're one character or whatever, but it's really how they move around stage. The characters don't move around stage. They, like, the characters sit at one table, and then when the actors move away from that table, in your imagination, you're supposed to believe that they're changing characters.
Right.
But, and when they come back to the table, you're back with that set of characters. So they're moving all around the stage. And the plot of the play is that it's this little seaside tavern, and, you know, one of the patrons eats something that has a, like, cartoonishly violent allergic reaction, but it's delayed. And so it's the amount of time between he might die, or between the time that he eats the thing and he might die. And the only hook is that he doesn't realize he's eaten it, but everybody else has. And so they're like, how do we... he's resistant for help. He's like, why do I need help? But they don't want to fess up that they fed him something that might kill him. They don't find out that it might kill him till after he's eaten it. Anyway, we did it. I had two great actors from Indianapolis. Shout out to Ariana Newhouse and Ryan Felton. In the earliest drafts of this, they hopped on a Zoom call with me in summer of 2020 and read through it with me. My wife and my sister, who, neither of whom are actors, also read through it with me. And I kept making edits and kept kind of tweaking things. Ryan and Ari, who really are real actors, like, we met at the beer garden at the Rathskeller, and we did a live reading. We did one over Zoom also, that we had kind of ironed out some stuff. And then just last winter, the District Theater here in Indianapolis agreed to put it up. So we did a one night only live reading where the actors, Ryan and Ari lives in New York City now, and she came back for this.
Oh,
and
wow.
It was amazing. Not for this. She came back for the holidays and for this, but she came back. So Ryan and Ari basically were still on stage with the scripts. It wasn't full blown, full costumes memorized. They're on stage with the scripts, but they're still moving around stage, interacting with props. It's more casual than the real thing because, you know, I feel like Ryan missed a line and Ari was kind of like joking. He was like, don't you want to ask me about, you know, like, and so it was a really casual, light atmosphere. It was a really casual, light atmosphere, but we sold it out. And
wow.
So it was watching that come to life with them and seeing my script come to life. So that is available. And actually, it's 1 year anniversary. What day is it? The 5th? I think it's 1 year anniversary is next week.
Wow.
So I'm pretty excited about 1 year of that being published.
That's awesome. Now, did I see you have some music on Amazon also? Is it actual recorded music or is it written music?
No, it's recorded music. I have a couple albums that have just accumulated through the years. I have more that I have put out of print than I think that's out there, because there was a whole era when I was in a rock band. There was a whole era when I was trying to be a singer-songwriter. Most of that isn't out there anymore. In fact, almost all of it is. I have one record that I made during the pandemic called Indianapolis, as in the word Indianapolis, but the word piano is in the middle. And I'm very proud of that. And then I've made two records with the Earful Tower. So I did one soundtrack to a season. That's not available on Amazon or Spotify or anything. That was, we printed it on disc. And that was 1,000 print run of 1,000. We don't have any of those anymore. That's out in the world. Then the album An Earful de la Musique is all original songs I wrote that we've used on the podcast. And we've used those to kind of supplement some of the other like French hits that we've remade. I'm really proud of that. I put that out, I can't remember, just last year maybe.
I'm actually looking at Apple Music.
Yeah.
And cool. you're all up on Apple Music.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. Earful de la Musique and Impinapolis are
that's Music. Pretty crazy.
Yeah.
That's awesome. You want to share one with us? I could put it. I'm actually Bluetooth to my
phone. Sure.
I could play one of them.
Play it. Play the you could play the opening track of Earful de la Musique is I think it's called Nostalgic for the Future of Paris.
Nostalgic for the Future of Paris. Let's try this. Folks, if this doesn't work, I apologize, but we're going to try it. That's awesome.
No, thanks.
So you wrote all that.
Yeah.
You were in a rock band earlier. That's obviously jazz. So you play across different genres?
Well, I just have grown, you know, I don't want to say grown up, but you know, people change as they get older, and I've played so much rock music. And you know, my friends in the Walk-Ons, that's a band I'm in now. I mean, we play all rock music, but that's sort of not where my heart lies like right now on music I create. So, yeah, the stuff for the Earful Tower is particularly jazz influenced because in my mind, Paris is such a jazz town. And when I'm there, I have specific places I like to go to hear it. And it's inspiring. I play a lot of bluegrass. I think there is some, there's some overlap in the Venn diagram of where bluegrass and
Nancy loves bluegrass.
Oh yeah.
It's too bad she's not here.
I know she and I would, sounds like she and I would really hit it off. So actually one thing I brought is this record that goes with Chinatown Troubadour. It's an album that I made while I was looking for Lucky.
And it's on vinyl.
It's on vinyl only. Can't find it anywhere in the world. Do you have a record player?
I don't know if we do now. We moved and we changed
things. Well, you can hang it on your wallet.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
Yeah,
thank
of course.
Nancy will love that.
Well, and so if you ever have a way to hear it, that is, I play tons of banjo. I love playing banjo. That's sort of my stress relief instrument and the thing that I just pick up.
And Nancy's really going to regret not being here for this.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, and so I talk all about it in the book. And so the behind the scenes of that album are in the book. But yeah, I spend a lot of time not playing rock music these days is the point.
Where did you do the recording?
I do it all in my house.
Really? You got your own little own studio area for recording?
Yep.
That's very cool. Yep. Very cool. Now, let's quickly, we're getting close to the end here.
Yep.
Let's talk quickly about your book publishing.
Yeah.
So are you a true independent published book or are you working through a publisher or how did you get published? What route did you take?
I'm truly independent. I did the Amazon. Well, I didn't at the start. I didn't do Amazon Kindle Direct Publishing. Oh, what was the first thing I did? I'm trying to remember because it was over 10 years now. Maybe I used Book Baby or there was a different one that started with a B. Either way, within the first couple of years, I tried a couple different independent publishing routes. And I never once went to an actual traditional publisher, even the smaller ones. I just kind of wanted to learn some things on my own. And I didn't at the time have confidence in the work enough to feel like I could really sell it. Now, on the other hand, I did look for a literary agent. I had all the confidence in the world to try and find someone who could help me, but I knew that I didn't know the publishing world myself enough. I tried a couple of different sites. I landed on Kindle Direct Publishing, especially after they acquired CreateSpace, which happened 7-8 years ago. I don't remember, because all of a sudden they had enough layout capabilities, enough of the design capabilities to make me happy there. Plus, I mean, I just wasn't getting a royalty rate close to that on other independent publishing sites. And I wouldn't get a royalty rate close to that from a traditional publisher either. The difference is you don't get your own, I mean, it's distributed anywhere Amazon exists. However, you don't get the marketing support, and the bookstore distribution support that you would get from a traditional publisher. I could talk for a long time about this. I don't know how deep you want to go, but that's that's the nutshell on how I got published.
Oh, very cool. Well, I think, Press, it might be time for our random question box.
Let's go.
Well, before we do that, and also let's make sure we get a picture before you go. Because,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, I like to put a picture up. But before we do that, how can people find your stuff besides Amazon?
Yep.
You got a Substack too, which is something new for me. So maybe tell us about that.
Yeah. So I write a newsletter on Substack that's just kind of part of my marketing arm, but it's also a nice way to showcase the art itself, And so you can find me on Substack just under my name, Press Maxson, PressMaxson. You can find the products themselves, the books on Amazon, but you'll hear from me more personally if you follow me on Substack. I'm on social media also. I'm on TikTok as Press Maxson Author. I'm on Instagram as at Press Maxson. I'll be your friend on Facebook if you want, maybe, unless...
Unless you're
really
weird.
Hot, weird. Yeah, I was going to say, wait, I don't know.
Unless you're trying to hawk t-shirts or something.
Yeah, yeah. Find me on Instagram. Let's start there. And so that's where you can find me. But I think probably my favorite places to engage are our Substack for sure is on Substack. And I'm looking for followers on Amazon and figuring out ways to engage there as well.
All right. Very cool. Very cool. You ready to do this random question?
I'm so fired up for it. Let's see what happens.
Let's see. So you got to pull one out. You answer first.
Okay.
And then I have to answer also.
Am I pulling a question to read to you and you pull a question to read to me?
No, we have to answer both the same question.
Okay. Oh, both the same question. Okay. If you had to show a tourist one place near where you live, where would you take them? If you had to show a tourist one place near where you live, where would you take them? Okay. I live on the far north side, sort of right where suburbs meet cornfields, up in Westfield. So, I mean, of course, the answer is like, oh, it depends what the tourist wants. But if it's really what I want, you know, that's tourist worthy, you know, you could try and eat the Big Ugly at Bubs.
Oh, yeah. That's how big is that burger before it's cooked? It's
1 pound of meat and half pound of bun. And it's doable. You're not super comfortable after, but some people eat like four.
That's right on the Monon Trail in Carmel, right?
Yep. Yeah. And so a visit to Bubs is built in with the Arts and Design District and some nice areas there. I was going to say there's also a little street in Westfield that's you'd think it's a neighborhood street. It's not on the beaten path of business districts, but there are some fantastic restaurants up there. So if my tourist doesn't like burgers, I'd say sushi at Chiba out on the deck is chef's kiss. Or I'd probably take them out on the boat on Morse. My family has a boat on Morse.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I got an answer for this because I just literally just did this last month.
Oh, cool.
So I have twin nieces who live in San Jose area of California. They brought their husbands, their mother, their kids. One of them brought their husband's mother, and they all came to Indianapolis for a makeshift family reunion. They took a vacation from here. They went to Tennessee and they did some other things, but they were in Indianapolis for about 3 days.
Cool.
And one of the places we went was the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Yeah. Okay. And yeah, that's good.
We went to the museum at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And folks, if you have not been to the museum at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, I highly recommend it. And if you have been there, but it's in years past, go back because they've completely remodeled it.
Mm.
And now it's very different. There's a lot more NASCAR in it. There's multiple floors. There's interactive things like putting the tires on the car.
Right.
You know, you see that in the pits, right? But they actually have the tools and they got setups for you to be able to actually do it. And you got two people that could get on either side of the car and race each other. There's things like putting the fuel in the car. There's all those kinds of things. It's fun. It's fun for kids. It's fun for older people who particularly like racing. So I took them out there and then gave them a little driving tour of downtown Indianapolis. And we ended up eating at Shapiro's for lunch.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
We had coffee at Calvin Fletcher's in Fountain Square. And cool. And then we walked on the canal downtown. So, but the big thing is the museum at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
So, oh, super cool.
Yeah, that was something we did. That was a lot of fun.
Love it.
All right, Press. Well, man, I so appreciate you joining me for this conversation on the Cutter's Notch podcast. Let me just say, folks out there, if you can, go look up Press Maxson on Substack. Look him up on Amazon. Check out his works, his music, his books. Quite a talented guy. He's into a lot of different things. And let's make him appreciate the fact that he was on the Cutter's Notch podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a real treat. Hit the
which one you want me to hit?
I don't know. You know, the music is too much. Maybe do the fairy one. It's just sort of magical and like...
Yeah.
That's my gratitude, you know, exploding out of me and heading over to your side of the desk.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. For me, it's more like,
just kidding.
folks, just a reminder out there. I do have, as Press does, I have some books for sale. So please check out, especially my new one, The Purveyor of Death. We're coming up on fall we'll be coming up on Halloween pretty soon. It's a great book for that season.
There's your eerie music.
Yeah, there you go. That's what spurred it on.
Yeah,
there you go.
Exactly.
And I have also some product up on redbubble.com. You can go check out my Henry the Preacher cartoon or comics and my Love Mentalism stuff. Speaking of Love Mentalism, you can check out my other podcast, the Love Mentalism Podcast. So I appreciate everybody listening in today. Bill Whitehair, thank you for your post-production work. I'm going to say that twice because I forgot to do it last time. So thanks, Bill, for your post-production work. And folks, we'll catch you next time on the next episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast. Your hosts have been Michael and Nancy DeCamp. Michael is the author of several fantasy thriller novels and short stories that can be found on Amazon or ordered through your local bookseller. Visit www.authormicheldecamp.com to learn more. His most recent release, The Purveyor of Death, Doc Moon Book 1, is a classic young adult horror novel and the first book in a new series. It's guaranteed to keep you turning pages. Nancy is Michael's number one fan with a love and appreciation for creativity everywhere. The Cutter's Notch podcast is available through most podcast listing providers. Subscribe to catch each new episode as it drops. You can reach us by sending an email to michael@authormicheldecamp.com. Join us again on the next episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast.